This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, August 30th, 2006. Filling in for Aldo Pagado, I'm Dante Toza in Philadelphia. In Iraq, 60 people were killed as Iraqi government forces tried to suppress movements that oppose continued U.S. military occupation. 70,000 people have been blocking major highways for the past 4 days between Balochistan and Pakistan in protest of the killing of the Palestinian leader Nawab Akbar Bukti. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Aaron Glantz with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan continued his tour of Middle East hotspots today, meeting with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas in Ramallah before heading off to neighboring Jordan.
Over 200 Palestinians have been killed since the end of June. This must stop immediately.
Speaking alongside Abbas in Ramallah, Annan urged an end to the Israeli assault on the occupied West Bank and Gaza. He also urged Israel to end a blockade of Gaza that's been in effect since an Israeli soldier was kidnapped by Hamas in June.
The closure of Gaza must be lifted. The crossing points must be opened, not just to allow goods in, but to allow Palestinian exports out as well.
The Israeli government refused to lift the blockade on Gaza, however, and continued its daily parade of military attacks. Manar Jabrin reports from the West Bank.
In its ongoing military operation in Al-Shija'iyah, east of the Gaza Strip, the Israeli army killed 5 residents today in the morning after firing rounds of live ammunition randomly at the residents' homes. A 6th resident was shot and killed by the Israeli army deployed nearby the city of Beit Lahia, north of the Gaza Strip. Today's killings bring the death toll in the Gaza Strip to 17 since last Saturday. A resistance fighter of Islamic Jihad's armed wing of Al-Quds Brigade, Hussam Jaradat, died today of serious wounds he sustained earlier last week in an assassination attempt carried out by a special unit of the Israeli army in the West Bank city of Jenin. Jaradat was on the Israeli army list of wanted Palestinians. He managed to escape 5 assassination attempts earlier. For FSRN from IMMC.org in Palestine, I am Manar Jibrin.
Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez is in Syria today, pledging solidarity with the government there amidst increased tensions between both countries and the United States. With Venezuelan presidential elections looming only a few short months away, evidence is surfacing showing the Bush administration funding Venezuelan groups working against President Chavez. Mike Fox reports from Caracas.
The U.S. government is again under attack for spending millions of dollars in the name of democracy in Venezuela. The Associated Press received 1,600 documents from the United States last week through the Freedom of Information Act, detailing over 130 contracts in which money was donated by the U.S. Agency for International Development to organizations working in Venezuela. Over half of the names of the grantees were whited out. U.S. officials say the aid is politically neutral and say the Chavez government would harass or prosecute the grant recipients if they were identified. However, President Chavez believes the United States is campaigning to undermine his government. This is not the first time the U.S. has been accused of supporting opposition groups in Venezuela. SUMATE, the Venezuelan organization which led the referendum against Chavez in 2004, is currently on trial for receiving $31,000 from the U.S. congressionally funded National Endowment for Democracy and under investigation for allegedly receiving $500,000 in undocumented foreign funds over the last 3 years. I'm Mike Fox for FSRN in Caracas.
Minutes before his last meal was to be served, the execution of Elijah Page was stayed by South Dakota Governor Mike Rounds over concerns over the state's lethal injection statute. Francis Lynn reports from Sioux Falls.
South Dakota law requires administration of 2 drugs, while most states who use lethal injection practice a 3-drug mixture. Governor Mike Rounds says he would not put the people charged with carrying out the execution in danger of violating the law. He is postponing the execution date for at least 1 year. Jerry Wilson, a member of South Dakota Peace and Justice, says the group will use the time to pressure lawmakers.
Everybody's been thinking about and talking about this pending execution. The time is ripe now for those of us who would like to abolish the death penalty in South Dakota to begin working to that end.
Many states, including California and Florida, are re-examining using lethal injection based on claims that the drugs may leave people conscious but paralyzed for an undue amount of time. In June, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that condemned inmates may challenge the lethal injection method as civil rights claims, although the court refrained from ruling on the constitutionality of the method itself. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Francis Lynn in Sioux Falls.
And finally, Egyptian novelist Naguib Mahfouz has died. He was 94. The first Arab writer to win the Nobel Prize for Literature, Mahfouz authored more than 50 novels, 5 plays, and scores of short stories and essays, depicting with stark realism the Egyptian everyman, balancing between tradition and the modern world. Often the scene of his novels did not stretch beyond a few familiar blocks of Islamic Cairo, the 1,000-year-old quarter of the capital where Mahfouz was born. Mahfouz was strongly political but kept a moderate line. He was a great defender of Palestinian right to an independent state and an opponent of the U.S. occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. But unlike the majority of novelists, writers, and artists in the Arab world, Mahfouz has been a supporter of the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel since it was signed in 1979. Novelist Naguib Mahfouz, dead at the age of 94. I'm Aaron Glantz for Free Speech Radio News.
The southern Iraqi city of Diwaniyah is on pins and needles today after government forces agreed a truce with followers of the Shiite cleric Muqtada Sadr. At least 60 people were killed in the fighting, part of an increasing trend of the Iraqi government forces directly confronting independent political movements. Salam Talib reports.
For months, residents of the southern Iraqi city of Diwaniyah complained that Polish and Iraqi military were disturbing their community by driving trucks loaded with armed soldiers through residential neighborhoods. A few weeks ago, a deal was reached giving security of the city over the Mahdi army of the Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. But on Tuesday, human rights worker Ahmed al-Ahmed says the local governor broke the agreement.
There was a deal formed between the Mehdi army and the governor's office that the governor's troops would never go inside the residential areas, that they would stay on the outskirts of the city. Then what we saw was the military come inside the city with a patrol, and they said that there were political pressures against the governor who pressured him to do that, but I don't know what they mean.
The Iraqi government claimed they sought only one man, the bookkeeper of Muqtada al-Sadr office in Diwaniyah. Regardless, the fighting quickly spun out of control. 81 people were killed, including 2 brothers, one who fought for the Mahdi army and other who fought for the Iraqi military. Eventually, Ahmed al-Ahmed says, a new agreement was reached to stop the fighting.
Now there is a ceasefire between the Mehdi army and the governor, but this ceasefire is only for 3 days. The fighting hasn't finished yet, and we don't know yet what will happen tomorrow.
The attack is not the first clash between Iraqi government forces and independent political movements. In recent weeks, the Iraqi military has clashed with Sadr followers numerous times and has staged attacks against other rival movements. Abbas al-Rubai'i is an independent Shia cleric.
I expect that there is a plan that's already in effect to attack all the movements that are against the occupation and those who are calling for a withdrawal of troops and a timeline for withdrawal.
Increasingly, members of Iraqi army have refused to go along with such attacks. Earlier this week, a Los Angeles Times reported 100 Iraqi soldiers of the battalion of 550 refused to be sent to Baghdad from the southern province of Misan. The British military called the incident a mutiny. Similar incidents have been reported but not confirmed in Diwaniyah. Again, independent cleric Abbas al-Rubai.
As individuals in Iraq, when you think about your security, you will know that you're targeted. Not just by the government or by the Americans, you can be targeted by a third party, most of which are armed, just because they don't like the opinion you stated in the news. So the Iraqis now, as individuals, can be targeted by any group, or even part of the same group that he's involved in, because they don't like his opinion. When the political situation changes, even his own group can attack him for his opinion. Anybody can be a target.
Separately, a gas pipeline burst outside Diwania, killing at least 36 people and injuring more than 120. The explosion was not part of the violence in the country, but because nobody had repaired it for years. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Salam Talib with Aaron Glantz.
70,000 protesters have blocked main highways connecting Palestinian and Pakistani provinces for 4 days. Police have arrested some 700 people on suspicion of disturbing law and order. On the fifth day of the death of Baloch Nationalist leader Nawab Akbar Bukti, the situation is still tense in some cities, while the capital seems to be returning to normal. Some nationalist leaders are saying that the Baloch nation will stand up for its equal provincial rights under the federation. Mazor Hussein reports from Islamabad.
Nawab Akbar Bukti, a fugitive tribal leader, was killed Saturday when heavy fighting caused his cave to collapse on him. Bukti led a violent political campaign since 2005 to gain control over the wealth from natural gas extracted in the region for ethnic Baloch tribes people. Sara Rao is a student.
He was a senior politician and had a hold over the people of Balochistan province. I think his death will have negative consequences, like the strikes and protest demonstrations in Balochistan.
That is not good for the future of Pakistan.
And you know opposition political parties will use the incident to pursue their own political agenda, and they will highlight the death to get political mileage.
Although he is seen by many tribespeople as a tyrant leader who himself led a major military operation against Baloch secessionists in 1973 when he was governor of Balochistan, but people fear a popular uprising aided by the large number of Taliban hiding in the province may further weaken Musharraf government. Asim Chishti is editor of Synergy magazine.
I think eliminating Bukti in turn would ensure that, you know, people will take this issue as a symbol. And they will now, for any reason, anything which is against the government, they'll pick up this issue and they'll go against the government. There's a lot of Baloch killing the locals and Punjabis, and they're trying to destroy their property. So that means there is a resentment now between the other provinces as well. And there's a definitely threat to the federation on those lines. So I think the government acted very prematurely.
A bomb blast in Quetta yesterday killed 4 workers, and the funeral procession for Nawab Akbar Bukti turned violent as mourners lobbed grenades at police and burned dozens of shops. Waqar Chishti is from the NGO sector.
The death of Nawab Akbar Bukti will have a negative impact on Pakistani politics. The thing is, if you kill a leader of a region and spread repression, then its people will surely develop a feeling of hatred against other people, and they may resort to violence against them.
While Bukti had a following among his tribe, he is certainly not seen as a revolutionary leader fighting a war of liberation. Omar Bajwa is director of Pashto TV channel AVT Khyber.
Since his birth, Bukti's lifestyle and profile has been extensively lavish. He has always been pampered by all governments in Islamabad. Going by his political patterns, he was never a nationalist leader. The fact is that nobody has ever been happy with Bukti. One reason is that he considered himself to be the equivalent of a British monarch. If you look at his lifestyle, he acted like a king. But in dealing with the people, he was equal to 100 Saddams put together.
News coming out of Balochistan hint of foreign involvement in destabilizing Pakistan, as President Musharraf is seen falling out with the United States, which considered him an important ally. Masroor Hussain, Free Speech Radio News, Islamabad.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. For archives of this or any other newscast, visit our website, www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. The wake of Hurricane Katrina has left tens of thousands of people without homes to come back to. The threat of luxury condos overtaking city blocks that was once filled with homeowners and renters is possible, making it difficult for minorities to own a home. Affordable housing for minorities is not only a problem in the Gulf Coast, but around the country, which is why an unlikely pair is hoping to help the problem. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
The NAACP and the National Association of Home Builders has come up with a plan to increase the number of minority homeowners. Today, though, they focused on Black homeowners. Bruce Gordon, president of the NAACP.
If they can make money by closing the gap on home ownership levels, that's okay with me. That's a good outcome.
African Americans own homes at a rate of 25% below whites, a percentage that hasn't changed much since the civil rights movement. The civil rights group and the Housing Trade Association says there must be an end to situations such as these. Again, Bruce Gordon.
In Gulfport and Biloxi, Mississippi, where I was this past weekend, and where we released a different kind of a study in terms of what's happened 1 year later, what we found is that of the roughly $5 billion that has found its way to the state of Mississippi, $3.4 billion of those dollars have been allocated to homeowners outside of the flood zone, Homeowners inside the flood zone have been allocated $0. And if you were to look at the ethnic mix of those two communities, you will certainly find a higher percentage of African Americans inside the flood zone.
Another example of that is a town actually in North Carolina.
Jerry Howard is CEO of the National Association of Home Builders.
They have a regulation regarding how much room must be at the end of a cul-de-sac, and understand that the value, the cost of the land is a large part of the cost of the house. And if a developer is putting in housing and he has to make the cul-de-sac larger than seems necessary, obviously that adds to the cost of each of the individual housing units.
According to the census report released yesterday, African Americans' median income is about $30,000. That's $15,000 less than what whites make. According to this coalition's report, federal, state, and local housing policies haven't accommodated minority homeowners. They're ignored through zoning practices and housing preservation programs. Housing affordability for the middle-income worker is also on the decline. Most affordable housing in metropolitan areas are located in the exurbs, which is past the suburbs. Predatory lending is abundant and buyer discrimination exists. The Department of Housing and Urban Development says they received more than 13,000 discrimination complaints last year, the most since records began a decade ago. Race was the reason 41% of the time, closely behind disability discrimination. Again, Bruce Gordon.
Through collaboration, we could begin to quantify these problems, analyze their root cause or causes, and come to a solution.
When he addressed the NAACP for the first time this year, President Bush pledged to increase the number of minority homeowners, a pledge the administration says they're fulfilling. Kim Kendrick is the Secretary for Fair Housing and Equal Opportunity at HUD.
In the president's budget for 2007, he increased the amount of dollars going to homeownership counseling because homeownership is a big priority for him, especially minority homeownership.
The president has also pledged to subsidize down payments for first-time homeowners. But while the president is pledging increasing minority homeownership, minorities who lost their homes from Hurricane Katrina are seeing little help. The community advocate, ACORN, filed suit because FEMA is threatening to end housing assistance tomorrow, 6 months early. Bruce Gordon with the NAACP says, above all, he wants to see policies already on the books to be enforced. He's especially concerned about community development block grants.
Will CDBG monies and will CDBG policy be enforced, and will funds be made available? That's what I want the Bush administration to do.
CDBG funds for newly developed housing say 70% must be affordable. The 70% requirement is often overlooked. It was in the rebuilding of Lower Manhattan after September 11th, and skeptics believe the same will happen in the rebuilding of the Gulf Coast, which doesn't help the problem of minority homeownership. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Implementation of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement signed between the Sudanese government and the Sudan's People Liberation Army a year ago is far behind schedule and is a cause of concern for the southern Sudanese authorities. The rebels are even warning possible resumption of full-scale war, blaming President Bashir's government of lack of goodwill. Joshua Kilimpa reports.
The president of the semi-autonomous Southern Sudan, Salva Kiir, says his only hope is with the international community to prevail over Sudan National Congress Party in power in Khartoum to comply with the provisions of the agreement.
There are areas where within the international community has distanced themselves from us, the mediators, those who actually participated in the CPA, to come along and put pressure on the National Congress Party, the other partner, which has now reneged in meeting its obligation.
Sudan is already locked in another diplomatic row with the UN over its refusal to allow UN peacekeepers in the separate conflict of Darfur. David Mafab is an expert on Sudan at the Kampala-based Pan-African Center for Peace and Security Studies.
Obviously, there were fears on all sides to, if you wish, take a step into the unknown. That, in my view, could explain this. That's why, clearly, the withdrawal of Sudan Army from the south is behind schedule. They have moved on the creation of the Joint Integrated Unit under Commander Thomas Cerillo. That one has been done. But the withdrawals from the south of the Sudan Army are far, far, far beyond schedule. There is the question of oil also. Unfortunately, the government of Sudan has not, as was expected, permitted SPLA people to be present to determine exactly how much oil was going out. So they've received some money twice instead of more frequently than that and got 50% of whatever the government of Sudan decided to tell them. Of course, the SPLM leadership has warned. The General Secretary, Commander Paganamum, has warned that if the CPA breaks down, or if the Sudan government reneges on that, then a new round of fighting will break out. Now, I'm very sure Khartoum doesn't want that.
Under the CPA agreement, a commission was to be created to oversee the sharing of the oil wealth by the Khartoum government and the Southerners. The former rebels of SPLA would be integrated into the National Army, and the climax of the agreement was the holding of a referendum that would create an independent state for the South, among other provisions. But the slow implementation of the agreement is making even some southern Sudanese who are planning to go back to their country think twice. These Sudanese refugees in Uganda feel the international community should intervene to save the peace agreement.
My name is Aleo Majok Aleo. Bashir is not really active in implementing peace or bringing peace to Sudan. There are other rebellions which are still emerging instead of bringing them to the table of peace. So I appeal to them that they come, they intervene, and they see the implementation of the CPA in the south, and also they see how the government of Sudan, which is being headed by Bashir, how it is really trying to bring peace to Sudan. We are really very, very eager to have peace in Sudan. We have suffered for so long time, and that has been enough.
According to what Aleo told you is the right, that CPA is just very slowly. Like now, infrastructures are not yet improved, like road, school, and hospital. And the government of the national unity long time ago has agreed that it's going to forbid social safety to all of South Sudanese. But now, things are very slowly. As far as international community is concerned, we would like you, international community, including those of United Nations, to come and forbid the security. Of course, we cannot enjoy the CPAs while others are still in dangerous, like those of Darfur.
The Sudan Comprehensive Peace Agreement was largely supported by the U.S., and Southern Sudan President was early this month in Washington to brief President Bush about the situation. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Charimpa reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
Drug harm reduction activists in Canada are worried that the federal government will not renew a legal exemption allowing Insight, Vancouver's first supervised injection site, to continue operating past September 12. FSRN's Allison Benjamin reports.
At Insight, drug users inject under the supervision of medically trained staff, obtain clean needles, and get access to addiction-related health care. Vivanna Smith from the Vancouver Coastal Health Authority explains.
3 years ago, Vancouver Coastal Health was awarded an exemption under Section 56 of the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act. Section 56 deals with the possession of narcotics. So having an exemption allows the supervised injection site to operate legally. It means somebody can possess drugs and not be arrested.
The clinic opened as an effort to curb soaring drug-related deaths in Vancouver due to overdose and diseases such as AIDS. Its exemption from federal narcotics laws expires on September 12th, and the government still hasn't decided on its fate. Robin Walsh is a spokesperson for Federal Health Minister Tony Clement.
We're still undertaking assessment of the pilot research project results.
Without an exemption, the clinic will close. This has prompted a campaign to keep its doors open. Proponents say Insight is a success, having prevented 453 drug overdose deaths in its first 2 years of existence. Mark Townsend is with the Portland Hotel Society, the organization that runs Insight in conjunction with the Vancouver Coastal Health Authority.
Well, mainly we're just trying to get the message out there any way we can, from like blocking traffic in Toronto to doing stuff in Vancouver or speaking to the media and all those kind of things.
Upwards of 15 scientific studies have been published about Insight. Dr. Evan Wood is an epidemiologist with the BC Centre for Excellence in HIV and AIDS.
Findings have actually been quite impressive. We published in the British medical journal, The Lancet, a study demonstrating that the supervised injecting facility had reduced the rate of syringe lending among injection drug users. Syringe lending is the primary mode of HIV transmission among that population. We also published a study in the New England Journal of Medicine which showed that use of the supervised injecting facility was associated with a 30% increase in the likelihood of starting addiction treatment.
There is widespread political support for Insight, from Vancouver's municipal and provincial governments to a coalition of former Vancouver mayors to Vancouver Police Chief Jamie Graham. But despite support in many political and scientific communities, there remains opponents to Insight's model of harm reduction. Barry Berger is with the Drug Prevention Network of Canada.
Even the 12-step programs of Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous recognize that total abstinence is the only way to go. We need to be there to be able to do whatever we can do, not provide safe injection sites.
Randy White, a former Conservative Party MP, also remains outspoken in his opposition to Insight. But in the end, the RCMP, Canada's national police force, may play the key role in deciding the future of Insight. Prime Minister Harper said he and his cabinet will consult with the RCMP before reaching a decision. In a report released by the RCMP earlier this month, criminologists recommended that Insight stay open because it has prevented overdose deaths. However, this week, the RCMP announced that it opposed the further expansion of safe injection sites across the country. The Prime Minister himself said earlier this year that he is philosophically opposed to safe injection sites, but would wait for evidence of Insight's effectiveness before making a decision. In the meantime, Mark Townsend and other harm reduction activists are worried that moral arguments will outweigh what they say is irrefutable evidence that the center is saving lives and preventing the spread of HIV. For FSRN in Vancouver, I'm Allison Benjamin.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Simba Russo and Monica Lopez produce our newscast. Aaron Glantz is a headlines editor. Leanne Caldwell is a Washington editor. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Antonio Ortiz and Eric Klein. For archives of this or any other newscast, please visit our website, www.fsrn.org. In Philadelphia, I'm Dante Toza, sitting in for Alda Bogado.